Welcome to That Is Good to Know Radio Show. This program focuses on you, the listener, by providing you information, strategies, and practical educational tips from successful seasoned business professionals. Now, with today's program, here's your host, Jeff Stanislow.
Hello, Tampa. This is Jeff Stanislow, your host of That Is Good to Know. And we have another amazing episode for you this weekend on things that are good to know. Our only goal here after you listen to the show is to just say, hey, that was actually good to know. Visit our website, www.thatisgoodtoknow.com. We are happy to be here on AM 1040 on Saturdays at 8 a.m. and Sundays at 10. Today we have a special guest, and we're going to talk about collectibles, and we're going to talk specifically about watches. And this guest is very special to me. This is my son, Jack Stanislow, who has been a watch aficionado for many years. He's still pretty young, 22 years of age, going on 23. But he is very knowledgeable about watches. Jack, thanks for joining.
Hey, Dad, how are you? Thanks for having me on the show.
So fantastic. Some people might be listening in and say, hey, this guy's having his son on the show. But I can tell you, as far as anybody that I've talked to and other people that I've talked to that know watches, you can hold your own weight in that category. That's for sure, especially when we've had discussions with other watch collectors and things of that nature. And so this show, I wanted to spend a little bit of time just talking about watches, and we'll talk a little bit about the Holy Trinity of watches and what have you. But tell us a little bit about yourself and, you know, why you got so interested in watches at such a young age.
Yeah, of course. So, a little bit of a background about myself, kind of more recent history. I attended Jesuit High School in Tampa, graduated there, and proud alumnus, and went on to attend Ford State University, where I received a degree in finance. And, you know, during my time, I think at Jesuit, maybe as a freshman, maybe going into Jesuit in middle school, I just became very interested in kind of the watch world. This is about, 8 years ago now, and there's a lot of exciting things happening in the industry. I can't really tell you what exactly got me into it, but, you always kind of wore a watch, and I'm like, I want to be like my dad, because that's what every son wants to do when they grow up. They want to grow up and, be like their dad. And I always just saw you wearing your watch, and I kind of wanted to get into it and learn more about it. And as I did, I realized that there's a whole different world of, there's a whole world behind the watch industry. And it's not only are these kind of wearable pieces of art, they're also quite utilitarian and useful in nature too. And, I'm kind of a tinker. I've always liked building stuff and fixing stuff. And it kind of was just right up my alley. And, when I am interested in something, I kind of just make it a point to try and learn as much as I can about it.
That's fantastic. This is Jeff Stanislow, and you're listening to That Is Good to Know. And our special guest today is Jack Stanislow, my son. And we're going to talk about watches. And, I think you kind of nailed it on the head, other than being utilitarian in many different ways. And transforming, over periods of time, starting with the sundial all the way to the Apple Watch and these kind of devices that are now available to us. It's been something that we've always had. But I wanted to kind of start our conversation in regards to just like the utilitarian part of watches. And there has been a historical saying, that there's the Holy Trinity of watches, and these watches have been around for a long time. And maybe you can enlighten or let our audience know what watches or what brands are considered part of this Holy Trinity of watches.
Yeah, absolutely, Jeff. There are many different levels of watchmaking, and there's a lot of fascinating brands and history and stories kind of between each of these companies, whether they're large or small, right? But typically, you know, seen as the pinnacle of Swiss watchmaking, are, like you said, the holy trinity of watchmakers, and there are three of them, all based in Switzerland. You have Vacheron Constantin, Audemars Piguet, and Patek Philippe. And all three of these brands are renowned for their illustrious histories and their overall commitment to exceptional watchmaking prowess, whether it's as, you know, developing feats of horological engineering or just the level of attention to detail and art that go into each of their watches. They have earned their place at the kind of at the top of the food chain, if you will, of Swiss watchmaking.
And are these all just like they're based in Switzerland? Is that where kind of that came from? Or, you know, can you explain a little bit further about like the history of these watches or these watchmakers?
Yeah, so all three of these watchmakers have histories that date back as far as the 16th, 17th century. And what's really quite interesting is Switzerland was not the birthplace of kind of high horology. And when I talk about horology, I talk about the study of time, the study of watchmaking. And, you know, they actually began to compete with established watchmakers in Germany, Britain, and France, you know, and they, the Holy Trinity kind of became a marketing ploy almost. And it's not to say that these timepieces weren't magnificent works of art, because they were, but as manufacturing started becoming outsourced away from kind of the big three in Europe, France, Germany, and Britain, Switzerland was able to identify this market for high-level timepieces and really go in there and dominate it. And they have for the past 100 to 200 years. And no small part, and thanks to this Holy Trinity, you know, they all three of these watch manufacturers mark their timepieces with a symbol known as the Geneva seal, which is a mark of excellence, essentially. It's basically saying that this timepiece has met a certain rigorous standard of craftsmanship, that, you know, it is to be adorned by this Geneva seal. And very few timepieces are adorned with this privilege. And the big three, the Holy Trinity, they do have this.
Again, Jack, what is the brands that are part of this Holy Trinity?
So we have Patek Philippe, Audemars Piguet, and Vacheron Constantin.
And these classic Swiss watches, is there a specific identity of these Swiss watches? Is it the movements? Is it because there's lots of different types of movements? Maybe taking a step back, you know, what movements are dominant in watches, and then what makes these Swiss watches, you know, so different?
Yeah, absolutely. So to answer that question, we have to look back to the mid 20th century with the invention of the quartz crystal as a timekeeping device, and essentially the Swiss watch industry experienced this period of tribulation where a superior technology kind of supplanted the older way of watchmaking, and for hundreds of years, time was recorded with machines, as it's called, movements, you know, and essentially you have a series of gears and levers and kind of internally developed timekeeping devices that were placed inside of these what were mainly pocket watches at the time, because the actual wristwatch is a relatively recent invention, and it wasn't really made popular until World War I. But watches as a whole have always been powered by essentially small engines, right? And these small engines, you know, are intricate, they're beautiful, and they were quite accurate too. And for hundreds of years, that this is really what most people, both individuals and professionals, use to measure time, right? And, you know, as time went on, these watchmakers were able to continue to improve these mechanical movements. And, you know, it had gotten to the point where by World War II, most mechanical wristwatches were quite accurate. They were able to meet some rigorous standards, such as, you know, roughly 99.9% accuracy, which for, if you think about it, having a bunch of springs and gears, you know, all ticking in unison, is quite remarkable. But the Japanese came along in the 1960s and invented this magnificent new technology called the quartz crystal.
And that was a game changer, right? The quartz.
Absolutely. The quartz crystal entered the market and absolutely shocked Switzerland, because you have a movement that is many, many times less expensive to make than these wonderful mechanical movements that the Swiss and the Europeans in general have had. And, you know, much cheaper and also much more durable and accurate, is much more simple. It's a quartz movement is essentially better than mechanical movement in every imaginable respect. It's like comparing, you know, the internal combustion engine to the steam engine, you know?
Yeah. That's really interesting in regards to you know, the change between the Swiss movement, very complex, very intricate, and the advent of the quartz. This is Jeff Stanislaw, your host of That Is Good to Know. Visit our website for this episode and many more. Thatisgoodtoknow.com. We're talking with Jack Stanislaw, and we're talking watches. So Jack, Swiss movement until the quartz watch was introduced. And has there been any new movements that or any mechanisms since those two? I mean, maybe other than the digital watches that are available now?
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, pretty much in the past 10 years, we've seen the rise of digital watches. The Apple Watch kind of comes to mind, but you also have some offerings from companies like Garmin and like Suunto, which offer some pretty unique digital pieces that are tailored for certain individuals, particularly professionals. But I don't think this has really affected the industry that much, because most of the established watchmakers have kind of found that you know, people appreciate the heritage and the history and the art of watchmaking. And really, after the quartz crisis of the 70s, it created an identity shift in Switzerland that took many years to develop. But people essentially, you know, thought of these quartz watches as cheap, inferior products, even though, you know, in pretty much most respects, they are better. It's kind of like the advent of vinyl records that we've seen in the past couple of years too. People just, there's a nostalgia to it. There's a passion behind watches. And I mean, part of the reason I'm so interested in watches is because, I definitely kind of bought into that passion and the appreciation for these little works of art. And a lot of people are like that. So the Swiss watch industry has recovered quite tremendously after the quartz crisis. And typically, you know, a lot of people I know that might have bought into these digital watches, well, they pretty much all own traditional watches too. And most of them, the Apple Watch is just an extension of the smartphone. They don't really consider it a timepiece, right?
It's more of an app per se. When you talk about utilitarian, you know, the utilitarian extension gets done through the app, which is just a wearable device now, not considered a watch per se.
100%. And I'll leave you with this thought too. These Apple watches are great, but they have a shelf life, you know. Someone that takes care of their Apple watch and gets a good one might get a couple good years of use out of it, but then it's just kind of like, it's a throwaway item at the end of the day. You know, meanwhile, the watch I'm wearing right now, which is it's an Omega Speedmaster. I've worn it pretty much every day for 5 years, and it's never broke and never will. I'll have to send it in for a service eventually, but just the, you know, me winding the watch every day, it ticks, you know, it's a much more durable good long term.
I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned, Jack, about the, you know, the not necessarily throwaway watch, but it's actually, you know, like with your phones, at some point in time, applications won't run on older devices, whether it's a Mac or an iPad. I would imagine the same thing will happen with the phones as technology increases. There's just, you know, hey, you can't run this app on your Apple Watch because the Apple Watch that you have, the hardware, the internal technology is just not good enough. So you'd have to go get a new one versus many of these Switch watches, you know, that you mentioned, or quartz watches. They can last for time. I mean, you know, like, dozens and maybe even hundreds of years, they're still keeping time.
You're absolutely right, Jeff. You know, it's, and that's, you are right. It's not that these Apple Watches are throwaways. It's just, it's a different type of timekeeping tool, you know, and you know, these digital watches, you know, I think I used the term shelf life before. They do have a shelf life. Eventually, they will not, their computers or their processes will not be able to handle future evolutions in technology as things pop up. While the kind of the beauty of these, you know, quote unquote archaic mechanical timepieces is, you know, they don't really suffer from that problem. It's just you have to, every roughly 5 to 8 years, you go to a watchmaker, and it's kind of like getting an oil change for your car. They go under there, they, you know, check the parts, make sure everything's good, put some new oil on it, and it's good to go for another 5 to 8 years. And these Apple Watches, there's no point in repairing them because you just go buy a new one.
Right.
And I think that digital watches they're never going to replace mechanical watches. Instead, they supplement watches. And it's like kind of another example of this is, it's just like aviation, for example. You know, I'm a pilot, and we have so many you know, digital devices in the cockpit that help us track time, whether it's, you know, universal coordinated time and all that type of stuff. But if you know, everything fails, most cockpits still have a you know, mechanical watch or a quartz watch in them as a final backup, because they are so robust and reliable. You know, yes.
Well, I would hope that it's got some more mechanical things than a watch if you're flying and things fail.
Yeah, so it's redundancy.
Yes.
Yeah. My point is redundancy, you know, and it's good to have. So it's, I think these technologies don't really compete. They coexist.
Right. Right. This is Jeff Stanislow, your host of That Is Good to Know, on AM 1040 on the weekends, 8 a.m. Saturdays and 10 a.m. on Sundays. And thanks for sharing your time with us here today. Our guest, Jack Stanislow, and we're talking about watches. Jack, why don't you tell us a little bit about collecting watches and what, you know, versus your Apple Watch, maybe other than if you had the first Apple Watch and never took it out of the box, and, you know, 20 years from now, it could be worth some value. Most of the people who buy Apple Watches aren't going to see that appreciation. What makes, like, watches appreciate, and, you know, like, what's the most expensive watches that are available, you know, out there, and how much do they go for?
Yeah, so that's a great question. When it comes to values and watches, it's very much like art. It can be very you know, subjective, right? It's quite fascinating to see all the different wonderful pieces that have gone up for sale, and there's so many different facets to it. So let's go from a retail sense. So, like, well, what are some of those expensive watches you can actually go into a store and get, you know, or buy secondhand market? Particularly, we're seeing Patek Philippe and Rolex watches have been, you know, just at record levels of kind of market premium. They're very well made, very in demand pieces. And, you know, basic economic principles of supply and demand say that when demand is high and supply is low, equilibrium price increases, right? And, you know, while these watches are wonderful, they might not be the most amazing in the world, they tend to be the most expensive because of that desirability. You know, I think of a piece such as the Patek Aquanaut, which might retail for $20,000 to $30,000 US, and we're seeing them marked up and being sold at $80,000, $100,000, $150,000 at one point in time. Even though the watch itself, the MSRP does not suggest such a markup, the market does, just because of the level of demand for these pieces.
Yeah, and COVID had a big impact on the watch industry, didn't it?
It did, absolutely. You know, I could go on and on.
And you will, because we're going to have you back. We're going to have you back for another session so we can have a full hour talking about watches, because I think it's fascinating. I think people really enjoy it. But yeah, tell us what impact that COVID had on the market.
Yeah, you know, I think just like anything, COVID had massive effects. I think we saw kind of supply being reduced. For example, Rolex shut down their factories in Geneva for many weeks, perhaps months at a time. I can't recall exactly, but you have a very high demand product that's no longer in production. And we saw prices really skyrocket. Alternatively, we also saw watches kind of being used as commodities. So as a transfer of funds, we're seeing some very wealthy and articulated individuals going to watches as a way to, you know, diversify their portfolios, and essentially they can be treated as liquid or assets or cash equivalents. And that was one thing we saw that was very interesting. So some individuals might purposely mark up certain pieces because they knew, you know, that transfer of value could be, you know, pretty quick and efficient.
Well, one of the things, and I remember going to a couple stores around COVID, like, you know, to the mall or whatever, you go look at watches and the Rolex department, it was like wiped out. There was nothing there, or, you know, or they were just the display watches.
They had a sticker. Yeah, display only. They love putting those stickers there. And I think that the market's improved. Production's been resumed, and most of the people that wanted those timepieces have acquired them, and therefore they're no longer actively searching for one in the open market. So we've seen watch prices soften over the past year or two, particularly as a result of that. You're absolutely right, Jeff.
I think a lot of manufacturers in the watch industry had an opportunity to kind of reset their, you know, their kind of like what they wanted to do with their brand. The demand wasn't there. They kind of just said, hey, you know, it's a supply and demand business. And like, if the supply is gone, we'll create the demand, and bring out new products, but we have a little bit control of about where we want to do it and how we want to do it. Jack, we got about a minute left.
You're 100% right.
We've got about a minute left, and I'd love to have you back for the next session. We'll talk a little bit further about, you know, the values of watches and like who wears what and the status or celebrity that kind of goes along with watches and the movies and actors and actresses. But before we do, just, you know, tell us a little bit about your favorite watch that you're wearing, the Speedmaster. We got about a minute.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. So, you know, it's a very special watch to me. To viewers listening, as you might have heard previously, I'm wearing an Omega Speedmaster. It was given to me as a high school graduation present by my parents back in 2019 when I graduated Jesuit. Very blessed to have had the gift, and the sentimental value is really what makes it so special to me. You know, to most people, watches are just watches. They tell the time, right? Something special. But to me, it's kind of a, you know, it's a reminder of my close relationship with my parents and what really matters in life, which is my family. And, you know, one day, hopefully I'll have a son that I could pass this down to and
fantastic.
Kind of keep that lineage alive. Yeah.
All right. This is Jeff Stanislow. You listened to an episode of That Is Good to Know. Our website, thatisgoodtoknow.com. We're going to bring Jack back and we can talk a little bit more about watches.